You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new political era may be dawning in Egypt or not. It's still too early to say, but the country has a long history of setting precedents that have been emulated throughout the Middle East, from developing a unique form of secular Arab nationalism to being the birthplace of radical Islam. Joining me now from Cairo is Tariq Osman, the author of Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Osman to our program today. Hello.
Hi, hello. Just call me Tariq, please.
Okay. As I was reading your book, I was struck by its prescience. Was this sudden uprising against Mubarak inevitable?
I would say a turmoil in Egypt and against the regime was certainly inevitable, and a major unrest within the Egyptian middle class as a bigger story was certainly inevitable, yes.
There are reports of a lot of violence on the streets today. Who's doing the fighting?
It's very difficult to tell, really, so far, Leonard, but what we are certain of is that until roughly 48 hours ago, the demonstrations were very peaceful. Over the past day or two, the demonstrators in Tahrir Square have increased, actually, significantly yesterday. There are some reports that they have reached between 600,000-700,000 to up to a million. President Mubarak gave actually a very emotional speech late last night, and it was followed by very notable significant groups of people across different parts of Cairo taking to the streets in support of President Mubarak. The very sad episode today is that one of those pro-Mubarak demonstrations have actually moved towards Tahrir Square, where the largest anti-Mubarak demonstration has been there for a few days, and there have been some clashes. However, so far these clashes are with just people throwing stones at each other, so we have not seen any escalation really that would be very dramatic, and hopefully we should not see that or shall not see that.
Are you willing to make any predictions about where the country may be headed after a week of demonstrations and Mr. Mubarak's announcement yesterday?
I need to put lots of caveats, obviously.
Of course.
I'm sorry.
Well, predictions never pan out to be true. You know that.
Okay. The way I would look at it, actually, is I'll take a slightly macro view, if you'd like. Right before the demonstrations that started a week ago, the main political players in Egypt were the regime, political Islam, and the liberal movement, in that order of strength, if you'd like. After the demonstration, or now, right now, the regime's grasp over power has obviously diluted or been diluted a lot. And now, to a very large extent, the regime is relying on the constitutional legitimacy, which is being supported by the military establishment. And that's fine, because it means that the main power on the street or in the country, the military, the army, is actually supporting the regime. But that does not translate into a popular mandate in any way. So, in my view, one of the main losers here clearly is the regime. And the regime is wider than President Mubarak. So when President Mubarak steps down, whether that happens next month or in September at the end of his term, it basically means that the political regime that has ruled Egypt since 1952, the coup or revolution of that time, for the past 60 years, has been severely weakened by that major conspicuous rejection by young Egyptians. If you take the second player, which is political Islam, I would argue they also have been severely weakened because, to a large extent, observers were talking about political Islam and specifically the Muslim Brotherhood as the main and sometimes the only real opposition to the regime. The protests or demonstrations of the past week have been very secular. All the rhetoric and slogans have been very nationalist. We have not seen Islamist or Islamic rhetoric or narrative or slogans at all. So here we have quite significant, actually very significant move within the Egyptian middle class that is secular and not religious in opposing the regime. To me, that's a fantastic development, and it weakens actually political Islam as the only alternative to the regime. The third player, which is the liberal movement, obviously is a beneficiary to this demonstration. However, they remain very fragmented, and we don't see a structure, if you'd like. We don't see a political narrative that can be put forward in front of the people. So I'm not going to make a prediction, if you'd like, but if you want winners and losers, I think the liberals have been a major winner. And another major winner, though a subtle winner, is the military establishment, which has always had a commanded massive respect from the Egyptian population. The way they handled the demonstrations for the past week has actually increased that respect. The new vice president in Egypt is a military man, is a general from the army who used to run the national intelligence, actually. And that might translate to two winners, if you'd like, out of that week, the military establishment and the liberal movement. I'll just stop here.
Well, your book is a history, and maybe we should go back to, well, not to the beginning, which is many millennia in the past, but let's go back to what set Egypt on the path to this current situation. Should we go back to the 1860s and 70s when growing British influence led to the occupation of 1882?
I would go slightly further back, and I'll go to Napoleon. Long story short, I'm not going to bore you to death, but basically, when Napoleon invaded Egypt, he thought, by the way, that this is the most important strategic country at that time. He was looking at the Mediterranean, obviously, and the old world. And when Napoleon withdrew from Egypt, the country realized how backward and how lagging it is in terms of modernity. And that set the country on a new road towards progress. And if you fast forward, 30 or 40 years, you find that Egypt started to build the beginnings of a modern country, mainly in terms of an army, modern economics, new banks, the beginning of modern agriculture in the country. And that ushered in, if you'd like, a new experiment, a liberal experiment in Egypt towards the end of the 19th century or the beginning or the first three or four decades of the 20th century, in which actually Egypt, specifically Cairo and Alexandria, were very open economies, quite integrated with international economies, specifically in Britain and France, relatively liberal. People sometimes forget that at that time there was a sizable, very sizable Jewish, Armenian, Italian, French, British communities in Egypt. But then all of that failed by the end of the Second World War. Why is a long story, but basically that experiment failed. And then it ushered in a completely different experiment, which was the one you referred to at the beginning, the Arab nationalist one, which was very confrontational to the United States, by the way, to American interests in the Middle East, to Israel. And during the 50s of the 20th century and the 1960s, that Arab nationalist movement was the main political trend, not only in Egypt, but throughout the Arab world. But that also failed by the end of the 60s. And again, why is a long story, but basically it failed. And what we've seen in the last three decades, initially under President Sadat and later under President Mubarak, is a complete reversal of this Arab nationalist experiment, if you'd like. Economically, the country moved from socialism towards utter capitalism. Some would argue unorderly capitalism, if you'd like. And on the foreign affairs side, Egypt, that was the pillar of Arab nationalism, moved to become an ally of the American of the Pax Americana in the Middle East, of America, if you'd like, in the Middle East. So a complete reversal. Today, 30 or 35 years down the line, that experiment also is clearly bankrupt, clearly a failure. I'm not going to talk too much, but if you add one more factor to this story, the sad story, if you'd like, that demographics are also becoming increasingly interesting. Egypt doubled its population in the last 30 years. When President Mubarak came to power in 1981, the Egyptian population was roughly 43, 45 million people. Today, it's about 80 or 81 million people. So you doubled the population in 30 years, which means that more than 45 million people today in Egypt are under 30 years old. Very new dynamic population or demographic block that also is seeking a new beginning, a new start. So three failures, if you'd like, in 150 years, and a look for a new start.
Well, my guest is Tarek Osman, whose book is Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak, published by Yale University Press. You write early in the book that Cairo, the world capital of the 1950s, has lost its glamour and turned into a crowded classic third world city. Cairo's descent mirrors the regression of the Egyptian society. So were things better under Nasser? Did they go into decline under Sadat and then Mubarak? Or did Nasser set all of those that descent into motion?
Difficult to answer, but the way I would approach your question is basically you did not have one narrative that started by Nasser and lasted until today. Though the legitimacy of the regime, the political legitimacy of the regime is the 1952 revolution of Nasser, or some would argue coup of Nasser, The legitimacy is the same, if you'd like, but the modus operandi, the way the regime has operated, has been extremely different under Sadat versus under Nasser versus under Sadat and later under Mubarak. Extremely different in terms of politics and economics and even the social workings of the regime. My argument is Nasser tried a certain socialist confrontational internal foreign policy approach, and that failed. And then Egypt relied or adopted a completely different program, and that also failed today. Whether Nasser ushered in the descent, I would argue, at the end of the day, if you look today from an economic point of view, there are many pros and cons, as understandable in situations like that, for the Nasserite experiment, the same also for the Mubarak experiment, some pros and cons. But overall, if you look at 1950, for example, the mid of the 20th century at Egypt, and try to speculate how this country would look 50 or 60 years down the line, by the end of the 20th century or the end of the first decade of the 21st century, I would argue, and I argued in the book, that most speculators, most strategic thinkers would have imagined an Egypt that's very different from Egypt today. Today, Egypt is very conservative. At that time, it was very liberal. At that time, in the 50s, it was very nationalist. Today, it's very sectarian-oriented. It was very cosmopolitan. Today, it's not cosmopolitan. Today, Egypt, at that time, Egypt was a worldly city, even in terms of social glamour. Today, it's certainly a lot from that. And much more importantly, and this will be my last point, in the 1940s and 50s, there was a sense of potential, if you'd like, of promise in the country. And I argue in the book that actually that helped Nasser have momentum for his project, because there was this sense of promise of the future holds good things for Egyptians. In the 2000s, certainly that was lacking. Young Egyptians, the 40 or 45 million people who were born in the last three decades, felt that they inherited failure. It's a very different social psyche, if you'd like.
My guest is Tarek Osman. His book, Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak, is published by Yale University Press. We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back and look at what happened to the Arab nationalism that was promoted by Nasser. What happened to the UAR, for example, and how that is reflected in the current situation in the Middle East, and then as much as we can fit in on Sadat and Mubarak. Stay with us. We are back with Tariq Azman, whose book, Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak, is published by Yale University Press. We should mention King Farouk for a moment. He was returned to power after World War II. Was he successful in managing the opposing groups, the Salafists, who then became the Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, and that other more liberal group that you talked about, which had led to what you describe as a literary effervescence between the 20s and the 40s, these two competing groups that seem to still be there as competing groups. Did anybody take him seriously, or was he hurt by his reputation as an international playboy?
I think he was not really taken very seriously, but that also is due to the reason or the fact that the political system at that time gave the executive power in the regime to the government and not to the monarch. At that time, Egypt was a constitutional monarchy where it actually was relatively similar to England or Britain today, obviously without the sophistication and the depth of the British institutions, but more or less following the same system whereby the king is more of a figurehead, really, while the government holds the executive power. The king, however, had in his hand the constitutional right to fire any government and call for re-election for the parliament. The main point, I think, that needs to be highlighted on that in that period is that the most popular political party by far in Egypt was Al-Wafd, or the Delegation, which was secular, very nationalist, and actually, very interestingly, the Christian Egyptians held extremely prominent positions and influence over that party, over Al-Wafd party. And that shaped, if you'd like, to a large extent, the political narrative of that political party, which was, again, by far the majority in the parliament, typically, and the leader of the Egyptian middle class.
Well, the Christians, Christians played a major role in the pan-Arabist movement throughout the Middle East, didn't they, even though they make up such a small minority?
Arab nationalism was actually born as an idea by a Syrian Christian philosopher, if you'd like, political philosopher, who, if you like, gave birth to the term, at least, of Arab nationalism. I argue that the mass appeal of Arab nationalism in the 1950s and 60s was due to a very large extent to the Nasserite project, which was very, very popular in the way it sold itself, if you'd like, to the Arab masses, not only in Egypt, but throughout the Arab world. So in a nutshell, yes, Arab nationalism as an idea was actually relatively older than that, but as a term was born out of a number of thinkers. Some of the most prominent figures of them were Christian, but the mass appeal, the marketing, if you'd like, was undertaken by Nasser and actually out of Egypt.
And you write that the popular veneration of Gamal Nasser in Egypt, or indeed in the wider Arab world, is arguably greater than any other political leader since the Prophet Muhammad, even more than Saladin. Why do you think that he still exerts that kind of influence on Arab aspirations so many decades after his death?
Two main points here, Leonard. Number one is that there is a historical incident, if you'd like. Nasser is the very first Egyptian to rule Egypt since the fall of the last Pharaonic dynasty, which I think is very interesting when you think about it. So for the past, 2,400 years, roughly, since Alexander the Great left Greece to invade Egypt and build Alexandria. Since that time and until the end of the Egyptian monarchy, King Farouk, not a single Egyptian has actually ruled Egypt, which is by far the largest country in the Arab world, until Nasser came. So that, by definition, by default, gave him a certain appeal and a certain momentum and made his reign appear as the emergence of or the revival of loads of Arab aspirations and ambitions. Number two, there was also a historical moment. If you note the end of the Second World War, the election of President Eisenhower in the United States, and who painted American foreign policy in very aspirational and ethical terms throughout the Arab world. It was the birth of the Indian democracy and the end of British colonialism, whether in Africa, Asia, in Egypt, the retreat of the French Empire in North Africa. So from a macro point of view, the moment was ripe for Arabs to think that they also can join this international revival, if you'd like. And then if you add to it the simple character of Nasser, who was a speaker, and he was an amazing speaker. Today we have President Obama, so you can draw some sort of comparison to the power of the word, if you'd like, the power of the spoken word. And he had this fantastic ability to ignite the populations. And he managed to exploit it, actually, brilliantly by having a number of media outlets that were, by the standards of the 50s and 60s, very effective in marketing him. So if you add all of that together, the historical moment, his ability, a number of international factors, that led to putting lots of momentum behind the idea of Arab nationalism and Nasser himself as a figure. This man, when he died in 1970, more than 6 million people surrounded his coffin. And why it's still his idea or the name still manages to inspire lots of Arabs is that because since his fall, if you'd like, or since his death and until today, there is a perception in the Arab world that Arabs have been subdued, if you'd like, that Arabs have been more or less either attacked by the West or forced to become, not necessarily forced, but where their leaders accepted to become allies of the United States. And until today, 30 or 40 years down the line, there's still this divide between the Arab leaders who are friends of the United States and more or less allies of American interests in the Middle East, and a very significant percentage, I'm not sure whether majority or not, but a very significant percentage of the Arab masses, specifically in the poor Arab countries, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Syria, Algeria, who very much see those interests as in opposition to their own aspirations. Whether that's rightly or wrongly, it's a different story, but there's this intellectual divide between the people and the regime.
I'm talking with Tariq Osman, author of Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak, which is published by Yale University Press. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. But what about his defeat in the Six Days War with Israel? Wasn't that a humiliating experience? Was he not blamed at all for it?
Oh, actually, it was a crushing defeat, extremely humiliating. And he lost dramatic part or portion of his appeal throughout the Arab world. And that was the basis why his successors, for example, in Egypt, initially Sadat and later Mubarak, adopted the pro-Western, becoming a pillar of the Pax Americana in the Middle East. That was the basis for the reversal of strategy and also the basis for many segments of the Egyptian middle class and the Arab middle class, certainly many among the elite, to label his project bankrupt and a failure and to accept the alternative, if you'd like. But the point that I was trying to make is that over the past 30 or 40 years, the strategic shift that has happened in Arab foreign policy, at least Egyptian foreign policy, certainly, was not necessarily sold, if you like, was not translated into mass appeal on the ground. One of the examples, actually, I find it very, for me, very revealing, is that in the second half of the 70s, after the Yom Kippur War between Egypt versus Israel, when Egypt signed the peace treaty with Israel and increasingly became a Western ally or American ally, one of the main marketing messages that was given to the Egyptian people was, by joining the West, your economic standards would improve. And that's one of the reasons why America, since the late 70s and until today, pays more than $2 billion to Egypt every year in aid. But when you think about it, this is an economic incentive, not necessarily an intellectual incentive. This is an incentive that speaks to your pocket, but not necessarily to your mind, not your mind and soul.
That hasn't happened.
Exactly. 30, 35 years down the line, your economic situation has not improved. Actually, in many respects, have deteriorated. Then the economic incentive has not worked. If your brain has not been accepting this modus operandi, this new strategy, then you stop and say, "Or why am I following this if actually my incentive is not materializing over 30 or 35 years? In my view, that has been a significant strategic failure, actually, in aligning the interests, if you like, of the United States, of the leaders, and of the people. But actually, that is what happened over the past 30 or 35 years. I find it very interesting that if you follow some of the polls, the official polls or independent polls on the acceptance of people in Egypt, for example, or Jordan, or Morocco, or many other Arab countries, of American foreign policy in the Middle East, you find that the level of acceptance is very, very low. And it's very interesting. A country that received billions, tens of billions of dollars in American aid over the years, still its people are more or less rejecting the foreign policy of the country that's giving them these billions. I think people should just stop and ask, why is that?
Now, Tariq, I want to go back just for a moment. What happened to the attempt to create a United Arab Republic that Nasser spearheaded? Why did it fail?
First of all, what actually happened on the ground was not a republic in the sense of the Egyptian Republic today. In other words, there wasn't really a complete integration between Egypt and Syria, the two components of that republic. It was more of a federation specifically on defense and foreign policy. The executive powers were completely different.
Were the Ba'athists already in power in Syria at the time?
No, the Ba'athists actually came right after the failure of that republic. And according to, if you'd like, the Nasserite narrative, they usually try to invoke the idea of a conspiracy theory, if you'd like, where the Ba'athists are setting the people against that republic. But I think if we rise slightly from these tactics and tiny small details and look at the macro picture, you're talking about the late 1950s, early 1960s, in which the Arab world was embarking a very aggressive and very ambitious socio-economic development program. In Egypt, and I'm not going to bore you to death because this can be actually a long discussion, but the main point is that in Egypt, that socio-economic development program was industrial in nature, to a very large extent industrial in nature. In Syria, because of centuries of the social dynamics of the country, it is a trading in nature. And when Nasser implemented his highly, severely, strictly socialist rules on the republic as a whole, to a large extent, these rules, these socialists, he confiscated, for example, or nationalized, for example, almost the entire private sector in Egypt and Syria. That could have been sold in Egypt and actually was relatively accepted in Egypt because of the heavy, complex industrial nature of the country. In Syria, that meant that you have made a very significant percentage of the Syrian middle class your enemies. You effectively confiscated their economic interests to the state. And I think that was a crucial area in the Nasserite program or the UAR, losing not only its appeal but also its credibility in front of the Syrian middle class.
Now, Tariq, we have very little time, but I want to ask you about one more thing. For the past 30 years, Egyptians have been hit with a lot of pro-Mubarak propaganda, but you note that in a lot of ways, Egyptians don't know him. Why is that?
I argue in the book that President Mubarak, for some reason, did not connect with Egyptians. And in Egypt, this is extremely interesting because Egypt has always been ruled by a pharaoh, if you'd like, by a godlike ruler. Even Nasser, Sadat, Farouk, all of them tried in some way, very different ways, to connect with the people, and they left their own imprint on the society. Mubarak did not try that, whether out of personal disinterest, his personal character, the fact that the demographics were very different. As I said, you have 40 or 45 million people born in the past 30 years. It's difficult to connect with such a very young population. But the end result is he did not connect with the people. The emotional link between the ruler and Egyptians, specifically in the Delta and Upper Egypt, the agricultural heartland of Egypt, has not been established during Mubarak's time. And I try to explain a number of reasons of that in the book, but it's probably a long discussion.
Now, yesterday I spoke with New York Times reporter Karim Fahim, and he said that Mohammed el-Baradei remains an unknown quantity to most Americans. Well, if Mubarak hasn't connected and el-Baradei hasn't connected, is there anybody out there that we are unaware of who has the ability to connect?
Well, the one who managed to connect very much over the past 30 years, sadly, is political Islam. And if you look at the sense of Egyptianism, if you'd like, the Egyptian identity, it has been in retreat over the past 30 or 35 years, while sectarian identity, Islamism versus Christianism, has been on the rise. That does not mean necessarily that the future in Egypt is Islamist, as I think I've said at the beginning, that the main winners out of the movement we've seen in the middle class over the past week has been the liberal movement because of the liberal slogans and narrative that has been put forward over the past week. And as the regime is a loser, political Islam is a loser out of these demonstrations. But one final point about Dr. Mohammed el-Baradei here. Without going into too much detail, but Dr. Baradei signifies, if you'd like, a very liberal project. But that liberal project of the Baradei variant, if you'd like, remains very much personified in him. He did not manage, so far at least, to build any structure around him that could be put forward in front of Egyptians as an alternative.
Now, just one more thing. We've seen three repressive regimes, Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak. Have they all governed pretty much in the same repressive way, or are we having, or did they approach controlling the country differently?
Extremely differently. Nasser had the legitimacy of consent, as I call it in the book. It's actually very difficult to sell to Egyptians today the idea that Nasser was an oppressor. And that maybe for an American audience might sound weird, but in Egypt, because it's a very patriarchal society, very agricultural society over thousands of years, there is a fine but clear line of distinction between a dictator and an oppressor. So he is, in the Egyptian psyche, is the benign dictator, if you'd like. And that's why, to a very large extent, millions of Egyptians still lament his days and have very positive nostalgia about his reign, even if it has ended in disaster. There's this idea of the loss of a father, if you'd like. Sadat, as I've tried to mention before, he, to a very large extent, presented his project through economic incentives. To some extent, he actually is the one who instilled political freedom in Egypt. He's the one who moved from the one-party rule to a number of parties. He's the one who opened the parliament, installed some sort of semblance of democracy, even if it was completely floating in many ways, but at least he put the seed. Mubarak actually had, to a very large extent, opened the media to have relatively free dialogues in Egypt. Egypt is far, far, and has been far, far away from being a democratic country, obviously, over the past 30 years. But he continued Sadat's line of establishing and further strengthening the semblances of democracy. The good news is Egypt today has the framework of a democratic country, even if the modus operandi, how this framework has been operating, is completely flawed. And if you follow my thinking here, it's easier, for example, to instill democracy in Egypt than in a country that lacks that democratic framework that has been working fortunately, but at least it is there. I hope my point is clear.
It is, and I thank you so much, Tariq, for talking with us. It's been fascinating. Tariq Osman, his book, Egypt on the Brink, From Nasser to Mubarak, it's published by Yale University Press. We've been talking to him from Cairo. Thank you again.
Thank you very much for having me.